welcome to this session with Jeff Sparrow about his latest book, Trigger Warnings, Political Correctness and the Rise of the Right. Jeff is going to speak for about 40 minutes and then we've plenty of time for discussion. I should also introduce him. Jeff is a writer, broadcaster and editor who works and is active in Melbourne, and he's kindly agreed to speak at this Marxism 2019 conference. I encourage people to save up questions, comments. For the end, there'll be plenty of time for people to get a chance to to speak and discuss things. And there'll be the usual drill, hopefully most of you will be familiar with by now in terms of how the discussions run, we do that 3 minutes, etc. And then there'll be some announcements at the end. So without further ado, I will hand over to Jeff.
Thanks, Leanne, and thanks all of you for coming. It's great to see so many people here. It's like a Zizek Peterson. Less cocaine, less lobsters. I was trying to think of what I would talk about in a way that doesn't intersect with the many other sessions that are happening here about identity politics and related topics. So I thought what I'd do is talk about the culture wars. Sort of broader sense is really what this book, Trigger Warnings, is about. And one of the things that's apparent if you spend much time engaging with culture wars in Australia is that they are deeply strange. I don't know if anyone here has been following Captain Getup. People know who Captain Getup is. If you don't know who he is, I'm not going to try to explain because it's a whole other thing. But and because of the strangeness of the culture wars, I think it's useful to talk about them through a historical lens, which is what I try to do in this book and which is what I'm going to try to do in the brief time that we have here. Because I think if you trace the development of these discourses over time, you can see the various tendencies that are at work making them take the particular form that they do, and perhaps get a little bit of a sense as to what's at stake in some of these debates, which is not always obvious. And one of the examples of the development of the culture wars that I talk about in the book, and I've talked about it a lot subsequently, so some of you will have heard this before, but I do think it's an interesting example, is a key trope of contemporary culture war in Australia, which is the notion of the radical prof, crazy prof. I'm sure you've all heard this. It's the idea that at the universities are full of crazy left-wingers who stuff students' heads full of left-wing nonsense. You know, and the contemporary version of this extends from the crazy prof to, you know, the crazy NGO person to the crazy... There are layers of crazy people, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all variants of the crazy prof. Do we have any crazy profs here? I'm sure there are. I don't know there are. I'll name you a little bit later. But the crazy prof trope, in its modern form, develops in the United States in the 1980s and takes there a form that's almost identical to the way it manifests in the culture wars today. So in the Reagan era in America, during the so-called education wars that fought during that time, the right in America begins to mobilise against so-called tenured radicals, the left-wing academics who allegedly dominate the campuses and use their positions to indoctrinate students with their crazy ideas. And so this trope has remained constant all the way through and still sort of dominates in culture wars today. But what's interesting, while go back and read some of the discourses from the American education wars in the Reagan era, some of it sounds absolutely identical, but some parts of it sound bafflingly strange. So, for instance, one of the most common elements of the iteration of the crazy prof trope in Australian culture is that the crazy profs are censorious. That's what they do. Crazy professors, they impose their crazy ideas on their students and they censor anyone who disagrees with them. And that's why the right-wing culture warriors in Australia invariably present themselves as proponents of free speech. We all know this. Yeah, this is what it means to be a culture warrior in Australia. Say, I am for free speech against the crazy profs who try to shut down debate with their crazy censorship. Go back to the debate in the mid-80s in America in the Education Wars. You find those two terms, free speech and censorship, yet the way that they presented it almost reversed 180 degrees. The crazy profs are being attacked, not for being censorious, they're being attacked for not being censorious enough. And this sounds really strange until you go back and look at the historical context, because, of course, the education wars, like the Reagan Revolution more generally, is explicitly a kind of counter-revolution against the gains of the 60s and the 70s, in this case how they manifest themselves in education. They attempt to roll back what the left has achieved in those decades. And of course, one of the things that the left in America and the rest of the world did was fight against censorship, against state censorship in particular, the very strict laws that regulated what people could, the kind of books people could read and the movies they could see, and so on and so forth. And that meant during that time there was a proliferation of much franker depictions of sexuality, of gender identity, and a whole series of controversial topics. And so one of the organising principles of the right at the time was to argue for more censorship. In fact, it's often forgotten that Reagan won his second term on a Republican platform that called for a reintroduction of tighter censorship. This is the era of the Robert Mapplethorpe photos becoming this enormous controversy. So the problem with the crazy profs in the university of the 1980s is they allowed all this filth to come and be seen by the students, and what we needed was more censorship at the university. So that's one way where the culture war was weirdly reversed. And the other way is related, but I think conceptually different. It's to do with the concept of elitism. Again, think of the culture war today, this is the key. You know, if we think of left wing, the word that follows is always elite. This is what the crazy profs do. They're elitist, they impose their elitist craziness against the honest Australians who have, you know, the sound instincts of common, ordinary, decent people. If you go back to the 1980s and the education wars in America, again you find those ideas, again it is totally reversed. The problem with the crazy profs in the 1980s is not that they're too elitist, the problem is they're not elitist enough. Again, you can see here how this plays out if you think about it historically, because one of the things the left had successfully done during the 1960s and the 1960s and 1970s had been to argue for the opening up of institutions that had meant in the universities, which had previously been largely segregated, there was now an influx of African American students, women students, students from different backgrounds. There was a new openness in these institutions, which was being represented on the syllabus. So there was a challenging of the traditional canons, and this was becoming a flashpoint about which the right was fighting. So, you know, some people might remember, you know, the David Williamson play, Dead White Men. This was an encapsulation of this kind of debate. The argument the right was making at the time is that universities should be teaching the great philosophers, and that, in fact, they've abandoned this elite tradition to, you know, open up the campuses to the point where you no longer study Shakespeare, you study a bus ticket. In fact, I actually did study bus tickets in cultural studies once. So that's a different story. But anyway, this was the argument at the time. The problem with the universities was they weren't elitist enough. And in fact, you still find echoes of that in the Ramsey Centre debate, which is about, you know, very much influenced by the Alan Bloom book, Closing of the American Mind, which was central to the education wars of that time, this idea that we should be studying the great text. But by and large, the right now positions itself as anti-elitist and positions the left. So to understand these reversals, I think it's probably a good point to discuss the concept of political correctness, because it plays an important role in these arguments, I think, and it's become a key rhetorical weapon of the right. Now, The phrase political correctness is adopted by the left, the American left, in the 1970s and the 1980s. And it's important to understand it was adopted as a joke. It was a term that you used to suggest that somebody needed to lighten up a little bit. They were too politically correct. They're only interested in politically correct films or books. The sort of thing you might say to a comrade who took themselves a little bit too seriously. I'm sure there wouldn't be anyone like that. No, the kind of thing. It definitely wasn't an argument for a particular political program. Nobody went around saying what the left needs to do is introduce this totalitarian idea of political correctness. It was explicitly a parody of that notion. And now, of course, that has been entirely reversed. Political correctness is presented as a left-wing project. People on the left want to impose as this sort of totalitarian philosophy that embodies the aspirations of the left. So how did this strange reversal take place? Well, again, you can pinpoint it almost to the day. There's a particular article that comes out of the New York Times in 1990, and this is continuation of the American education wars that have been sort of fought to a bit of a stalemate and are then reopened on a new front by an article in the style section of all things of the New York Times that says the American campuses are gripped by what people are calling political correctness. And interestingly, in that article, they say this is actually a satirical term, but then they go to say, well, it doesn't really matter because it sort of pretty much describes what's happening. And from that single article, the term then proliferates all over the world. And in the book, I did a little bit of a study of the number of times that it gets used in the media. And you can see it just shoot up like a rocket after that article. And from then on, it becomes kind of a core part of the lexicon of political debates. And to understand why it becomes so important and so central to the right, there's another really interesting early presentation of it that happens in February 1991, when the first George Bush addresses a commencement ceremony at an American university. And this happens at a really kind of hinge moment in the 20th century. You think of that year, Stalinism has collapsed all over the world, communist parties are disintegrating everywhere, Eastern Europe is in turmoil. At the same time, Nelson Mandela has been freed, and apartheid is on the verge of collapse. Now, if you think of the implications of the defeat of apartheid, one way to think about it is that this was a historical event, which meant that if somebody was arguing for racism or defending racism on an American campus, you would then be able to be in a position to present them as an enemy of the kind of freedom that Nelson Mandela. The left was winning this argument. Arguing for racism, defending racism, made you an enemy of freedom. Nelson Mandela had showed that apartheid was over. Mandela was free. What Bush did, however, in that speech, he discussed freedom except through the paradigm of the collapse of Stalinism in Europe. And he said, what we saw in these countries was a struggle for freedom against the totalitarian idea that you can be told what to think, and what to say, and what to act, and what to do. And this kind of notion is being replicated right here on your campus, and it's called political correctness, and we need to fight against it. And so what he does in that speech is entirely reverses the terms in which entirely reverses the ways in which notions like racism might be thought about, because all of a sudden you could say, when you're expressing a racist opinion, that you weren't fighting against freedom, you were fighting for freedom, because you were fighting against this oppressive notion of political correctness in a way you were just like Nelson Mandela. And people can laugh, but in fact, this is what people did. So political correctness comes to Australia in 1995 and 1996, the time in which John Howard and Pauline Hanson are doing this sort of strange dance amongst Howard's, in the context of Hanson's first incarnation. And this notion that, saying racist or sexist things was in fact struggling for freedom was a really kind of key part of the emergence of Hanson for the first time, and was really baffling for most of the left to deal with. Actually, if you look back on that time, what's really interesting is the number of people on the left who embraced the war against political correctness. Philip Adams does, for instance, which surprised me until I read it. But this number of prominent figures on the left who put their names to, you know, denunciations of political correctness. Okay, so I don't want to suggest then that the success of political correctness, its ability to become a kind of key concept for the right, is simply a matter of a rhetorical framing, you know, like that sort of don't think of an elephant kind of thing. Because it is a very successful rhetorical frame, but it's not successful simply because of that. It's also successful because of a number of key changes that have happened in Western politics, and specifically within the Western left. And in the book, I have this sort of three-part heuristic device that I try to explain the one way to think about how these changes develop. And I suggest that the ways that people on the left think about racism, sexism, homophobia, and the fight against these ideas is very much shaped by the new social movements of the 60s and the 1970s. And that these new social movements, at least in their very early stages, are dominated by something that in the book I call direct politics. And the one sentence summary of direct politics, the sort of cheat note takeaway, is direct politics is a politics where the people are presented as the solution. So across all of these social movements, activists, more or less, irrespective of their politics, shared a common sensibility that oppression was caused by society and the state, however you wanted to think about that, and therefore needed to be fought against by the people, however you wanted to think about the people. And therefore, the key way to fight oppression was to mobilise ordinary people in a way led from the bottom up in a participatory campaign of some kind, another, and that these campaigns had some kind of connection with each other. So that, for instance, national liberation gives rise to black liberation, which is then finds echoes in women's liberation, gay liberation, and so on. So, of course, there are different perspectives and different ideas within these movements, but there's a common kind of commitment to this idea of direct politics. So, you know, in a sense, it's that which kind of really gives us the sort of image of the 60s and 70s. And then in the book I suggest that by the mid-70s, and certainly through the 80s when the education war started to happen in America, we see the rise of a different kind of politics, a politics that I call delegated politics. And the one-sentence summary of delegated politics is that the people are the beneficiaries. And this was a kind of politics that was, on the one hand, created by a sense the movements themselves were dying away. Harder to mobilise people on the streets, but it was also facilitated by a layer of activists who had achieved a certain degree of stature, a certain degree of status within various institutions. Most obviously, though, not solely, the university. And in that context, and in a context where it seemed increasingly difficult to mobilise the left, a notion that, in fact, the way that one fought against oppression, the way that one created social change, was to use the institutional power that you achieved to implement reforms on behalf of the people. And I'll talk in a little bit about how that plays out, but that's the sort of basic idea of delegated politics. And then later on I suggest, and in the book I identify this with the 2000s in particular, delegated politics evolves to something that we might call smoke politics. One sense takeaway from smoke politics is the people are the problem. And I think this became particularly prevalent after the Iraq War in the US, around about the time of the second Bush presidency. There's a particular movie that I think about as kind of exemplifying the ideas of smoke politics. It's a movie called Idiocracy. I don't know if anyone has ever seen. But it's, you know, this is supposed to be like a satire of the Bush administration. But and it's set in this science fiction. Future. The core conceit is Clever people have stopped breeding. Stupid people have multiplied. And now America is dominated by these kind of morbidly obese drones who spend all their time masturbating and watching reality TV shows called Ow, My Balls. But at the time, it was presented as an illustration of the problems that the left was having in America at the time. The problems were caused by the fact that ordinary Americans were too stupid to appreciate the good ideas that the left had. And so the central notion of smart politics is that clever people like us should fight against oppression. Ordinary people should be kept quiet because otherwise they'll just fuck things up for everyone. So I'm going to give you like sort of two examples of how this plays out in ways that sort of illustrate key themes related to identity politics. I know there's a talk about identity politics tonight, but it's inevitable we cover some of the same things. The first one is to do with terminology, and the second one is to do with representation. The question of terminology is something that always arises whenever there is serious political change. That's why we shouldn't be scared of the notion of identity. Identity is always important in politics. Whenever there is a radical change of social conditions, people begin to think about the way that they want to be described, the way that the kind of symbols that they want to use, the sort of identity they want to claim for themselves. So I was actually, when I was preparing for this book, I don't actually think I put it in there, but I was reading a lot about the French Revolution. There's these great descriptions of English tourists going over to France, where after the revolution, the French have adopted peculiar clothing, these strange sort of, you know, ways of talking to each other. And you really expect these English tourists to be like, political correctness gone mad in France. totally lost my point. So terminology is always something that's important in social movements. You can see this running through the 60s. The example that I use in the book comes from Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. I don't know if people know this document. It's a really great piece of writing, and it's constructed after he's been arrested, after civil rights and mobilization, and he's been thrown in jail under brutal circumstances, and then learns that a bunch of white clergymen have written an open letter saying that the civil rights movement is going too quickly, needs to slow down. Alienated people. So he essentially writes this document about why we can't wait. And one of the things he talks about is like how humiliating and demoralizing it is to be an African American and to find that your parents are never addressed by honorifics. They're always called boy or girl or whatever. That, you know, you're never called by your name, you're always called by the N name. A whole series of belittling terms used for African Americans. In fact, when I was working on the biography of Paul Robeson, I went to a town called Williamson, I think. It's near where the white family who had owned Paul Robeson's father, a slave, they still lived there. And the freedom movement there in the 60s, one of their key demands related to the terms that the police used and all the officers in the town used when they dealt with black people. How something that this terminology meant so much to people at the time, it was one of the key demands of the freedom movement. Except, of course, if you read the rest of King's document in that letter from Birmingham Jail, he goes on to list all the other things the movement demands as well. An end to lynchings, an end to police violence, better jobs, better housing, a whole program of demands that, if implemented, would have dramatic implications for ordinary African-American people and would affect the poorest African-American people the most. And what's more, would have a resonance amongst the working class more generally, irrespective of racial identification. A project to end police violence would actually resonate quite widely with white Americans of a working class background, as would a program for more jobs. So the demand about terminology is presented as part of a much broader project for social change. When, however, you start talking about delegated politics, you get a situation where activists who are now in a position of some authority on campuses are no longer confident that they can mobilise large numbers for, you know, working class people in particular. And so instead of putting forward demands for social transformation, the tendency that developed with identity politics in the 1980s was to concentrate on symbolic change in a particular institution where you have some kind of institutional place. So increasingly what that meant was that, you know, activists would concentrate on symbolic change within a particular campus, a change of terminology, a redefinition of how people talk on that campus. There was nothing wrong with this. In many ways, this was a necessary thing to do. The campuses where it was being implemented were incredibly racist, incredibly inhospitable to, you know, African-American students who were a tiny minority. At the same time, these were changes that almost by definition were not going to resonate with the vast bulk of African-Americans who were never going to go to that campus. So these were this emphasis on terminology in a very different way to the way King was putting it forward, was presented in a way that would benefit most relatively privileged people, yet that was extended as if it would benefit the entire population. And how are we going for time?
About 25 minutes.
And then if we start to think about how the focus on terminology manifests in relation to smart politics, we see something quite different, and I think something that we could say is definitely pernicious. Because, of course, if your political perspective is that ordinary people are the problem, what ordinary people can do in social change is to do nothing at all and stay out of the way where clever people like you can do all of the work, then having a quite esoteric vocabulary that you police with a great deal of ruthlessness becomes tremendously important. Because, of course, anybody, any ordinary person, particularly they haven't done cultural studies, gone to university, who starts to get involved in a movement for social change for the first time, will very often not know the vocabulary that activists use. They will very obviously commit a faux pas, use the wrong terminology, sometimes in an offensive or overtly racist way. And there are two ways you can respond to that. The tradition of direct politics would be to say, this is not a terminology that we use, and here are the reasons why. It's very important for us to unite together. We need the broadest possible unity. That's why these sorts of offensive terminology shouldn't be used, and try to draw that person into struggle. The tradition of smart politics is to destroy that person and to weaponize the terminology, you know, through things like culture or whatever, and to ensure that that person will never be involved in the free party. I mean, I don't have to go. So, the second example I wanted to use pertains to representation. I wanted to talk about this because I work in publishing and media a little bit, and arguments and debates about representation are now probably the most hot, or the most significant forms in which politics comes up in those. For instance, if you go to a writers' festival, you know, insofar as the political arguments, the political discussions, or the political interventions will be about getting diverse representation on the panel that is speaking in front. And this is a good thing. Obviously good to have diverse representation in institutions that have previously been really white. But I want to think a little bit about what this means as a strategy for social change. And this was something that I thought about quite a bit when I was working on the book about Paul Robeson, No Way But This, because questions of representation were tremendously important in Paul Robeson's life. His father was a slave in the South, who escaped at the end of the Civil War, and had gone to Lincoln College, where he'd taken a divinity degree during Reconstruction and established himself as a clergyman, which is an extraordinary thing to do for someone who, at age 15, couldn't read or write, you know, to master ancient Greek and Latin. But that meant that he had become very convinced by the politics that were circulating in Reconstruction amongst educated African Americans, which were very much based on the idea that He was necessary for talented people to succeed, to set an example that would be followed by others. You know, the idea of the talented people. There are various other ways that it was put forward, but there was a consensus that this was a way that racism would be overcome. And William Robeson very much educated Paul Robeson's son to feel responsible for the example that he would set. Because, I don't know if people know anything about Robeson, but he was an insanely talented person. I could get distracted and do a talk about Paul Robeson, but he was an athlete, he was a singer, he could do all these amazing things. From a very early age, he was told by his father, you have to succeed. There's an example when he won a scholarship to Rutgers University, which previously had been all white. He'd been invited to try out for the football team, which was all white. He turned up for the first training, the whistle blew, all the white players attacked him, broke his nose, knocked him unconscious, and put him in the hospital for a fortnight. And when he was in hospital, his father came to visit him, and Paul said, look, Pops, I don't want to play sport anymore. I'm sick of being brutalized by white people. And his father said, well, son, you have to remember you're not there on your own behalf. You're there on behalf of all the other black kids who want to go to college, who want to play football, and are never going to get a chance. So you have to go there and you have to show that you can take whatever has been dished out to you. You have to set an example. And this is what Robeson did all through his life. Later, however, he became very close to the communists, essentially became a communist and became attracted to a version of the politics that I describe as direct politics, a version of direct politics. And increasingly, he began to question the efficacy of the notion of representation. He began to say, I'm always on these panels where I'm being held up as a successful African-American man, and what is the point of this? What does it actually say to other people? It says to them, you can succeed if you try hard enough, and it's not true. Actually, the main obstacles African-American kids succeeding, he said, would be the lack of education, the structural problems that keep them in poverty, police brutality. If we want African-Americans to have a decent shot of building a decent life, we have to tackle these structural problems rather than simply hold up examples and representatives and tell them to be more like that. And I think in the modern era, we can see how this plays out in terms of identity politics. We think of the administration of Barack Obama and the tremendous kind of exaltation that there was in some circles of the left about the first African-American president. And there's no doubt this was tremendously inspiring for a lot of people. But the question was, what happened with that inspiration? What did that inspiration inspire people to do? Here is someone who had gone through Chicago, machine politics, and had gone through, mainstream politics. It wasn't simply a case that people could just pick themselves up by the bootstraps and follow in Obama's footsteps. The problems weren't the people, the problem were the structures that needed to change. And in fact, you can see how, in the case of Obama, politics of representation gave themselves over to smug politics very, very easily. And Obama himself would repeatedly do this, where he would address forums in black communities and would say, the problem is you people. You know, the problem is black fathers, the problem is drug addiction, the problem is the kids that have baggy trousers, listen to hip-hop, rather than talking about the structures of American capitalism that replicate patterns of racism. Okay, so why does any of this matter? I want to give two examples. One pertains to an incident that happened in an Ottawa university in 2015, where a university student union cancelled a yoga class being delivered by a white yoga instructor, allegedly on the basis that this entails cultural appropriation. Do people know what cultural appropriation is? Yeah? Okay, so the argument was that this was cultural appropriation. And like so many of these cultural things, it's not altogether clear that is actually what happened. It seems that there was it was taken up by the press. It became cause célèbre all over the world as an example of political correctness gone mad. It's not actually clear who argued what and who was involved in it. But nevertheless, this is the way the argument went. White people doing yoga was cultural appropriation. And in the furor that followed, the student activists received support from an unexpected direction, which was, of course, people probably heard this story, the leader of the American alt-right, Richard Spencer, who was a genuine white supremacist and a genuine modern-day Nazi. What was the argument that he made? He said, well, what the students are doing in opposing cultural appropriation is good because it's a step towards having a degree of racial consciousness. And this was the argument that he put forward. Now, I want to be really careful here. I'm not trying to suggest that identity politics is fascism or people who agree with identity politics are fascists. But there was a kind of logic to what Spencer... Well, partly what Spencer was doing is the word trolling as well. See, he knew that this would upset people. But there was a certain logic to it as well. Because if you say a certain cultural practice is, say, black, and therefore white people who engage in it are engaging in cultural appropriation, the direct and obvious implication of that is that there is such a thing as black culture, that all blacks have some connection to. But it also implies there's such a thing as white culture, and that white people should be doing white culture. And as soon as you say that, you are opening up, a really nasty logic, which dovetails quite neatly with the sort of arguments that a white supremacist like Richard Spencer could make. I mean, so again, I'm not saying that identity politics is fascism, but the arguments that it rests on are arguments that have a genealogy that goes back throughout the 20th century to the 19th century to the right and not the left. Arguments about ownership of culture and the necessity of people sticking to particular cultures is an argument that comes from the right. In the 20th century, the people who argued this most aggressively were the far right, and again, the Nazis in particular. By contrast, the left in the 20s and the 30s argued for cosmopolitanism, argued for cultural hybridity, argued for solidarity, argued for breaking down national barriers and allowing cultures to mingle. And this wasn't just in the 20s and 30s. I don't know how many people here were at Dave Renton's talk earlier, when he was talking about the anti-Nazi League and the fight against the National Front in the 70s in Britain. The National Front were all about protecting cultural barriers and protecting white culture. By contrast, the leftists who were fighting against them were putting on events like Rock Against Racism, and because they were engaging in forms of direct politics, one of the things that came out of that was cultural intermingling. So, you know, Bob Marley wrote a song about it, Punky Reggae Party. It's about black and white people working side by side and learning from each other. There's a great quote from one of the members of a reggae band, Aswad, from the time, who talks about one of the things that happened through the Rock Against Racism carnivals. White people started listening to black music for the first time. They started learning about black culture, you know, and going to black dances. And this was a good thing because it enabled solidarity between the two groups. Now, obviously, it's more complicated than that. Maybe this is something we can revisit. But I do think it's not a coincidence that one of the major tendencies of far right in Europe at the moment is called identitarianism, because it is an argument that says there is a culture that belongs to black people, there is a culture that belongs to Asian people, and a culture that belongs to white people, and they should all be separate. And I don't think this is a position of the left. The second reason why I think this matters comes back to something that I started with, which is how it is that the arguments about politically correct elites censoring ordinary people, the crazy profs censoring ordinary people, how do these ideas get in the currency? Anybody who's been at a university knows that, in fact, universities are not dominated by crazy professors. They're not dominated by left-wing indoctrination. In fact, they are billion-dollar industries. You're far more likely to lose your job if you say something about trade unions or Palestine than if you say something politically incorrect about Muslims. So how does this crazy idea of left-wing censoriousness get here? Well, it gets a hearing because even though the left is not running these universities, even though these universities are not dominated by crazy, the tendency of delegated politics and smug politics does push in a direction where some activists think this is what fighting oppression is. Fighting oppression is about capturing certain positions and then using institutional power of some kind to, you know, to change the regulations in such a way as to make particular formulations punishable for some way, shape, or form. Again, everyone knows what I'm talking about. It's always overstated by the right, but it is a real phenomenon, and it's a phenomenon that is becoming increasingly difficult for left-wingers to defend because it has become so unpopular on the far left. So it becomes a major force of mobilisation for the right to, you know, attack a political correctness which resonates with some things people hate about modern politics. So what do we do in response to this? Because there's, and I'll end on this, I mean, there's a very common response to this that came out of the 2016 election when after Trump won, which was to say that, well, because the left's embrace of these esoteric doctrines about gender, sexuality, and race is alienating ordinary people, who give some sympathy to arguments about political correctness gone mad. And what we need to do is we need to reorient to the working class, and that means adopting a program of working class demands. Working class demands are always understood in these kinds of arguments in terms of unionism, pay, bread and butter issues. And, of course, the irony about this is in fact a form of identity politics, because it's based on an understanding of the working class in terms of particular cultural traits associated with stereotypical white workers. That actually is a form of identity politics in and of itself. Of course, everyone here knows that the working class is multiracial. Multi-gendered, includes people of all faiths and no faiths. And so because of that, actually taking up demands about gender, about sexuality, about racism, are working class demands. Or at least they are working class demands if they are formulated in the right way. And that, I think, is the crucial task for the left. I mean, the common formulation is that political correctness has gone mad. I'd like to say that it hasn't gone mad enough. That I express, it's not actually the greatest slogan. But that rather than retreating on questions of gender, sexuality, or race, what we need to do is intensify the degree of agitation around it. So I'll give you an example from comes directly out of the 2016 American election. After Trump's victory, there was a common kind of liberal trope, was that progressives in America spend too much time talking about bastards. I don't know if people have heard this, yeah. And what that meant is that Donald Trump would be able to win because progressives had become obsessed with transgender issues and who was using what bastard. Yeah, and so the argument was we need to abandon these alienating issues and get back to working class. But of course, transgender people are part of the working class, and these issues are working class. And it's not hard to think of ways that they can be articulated in forms that resonate widely. In Australia, of course, we have the example of the Safe Schools program as a good example. Because, of course, if you start to say, well, actually, transgender kids suffer from horrendous bullying and high degrees of suicide and self-harm, and this is something that we need to address, and the way that we need to address it is to fund an education system that is fundamentally underfunded, an education system that fails not just transgender kids, but most working class kids. In fact, working class kids of all backgrounds and identities find education to be a fairly horrifying experience. And so we actually need to campaign to pump funds into these staff schools to make them, to create programs that make schools safer for people who are particularly at risk, but also to make these schools safer for everybody who attends them. And as soon as you formulate a program like that, it's like we are the ones who are arguing for massive injections of funds to school programs. This is not a hard program to sell. Do you know what I mean? So the demand for the articulation of a fight against oppression is not an unpopular program. The problem is, I think, that at the moment, these kind of demands are too often articulated in ways that make them relevant simply for the top 1% of society, whereas we need to speak on behalf of the majority of society. I think as soon as we do that, we find that the fight against oppression can be tremendous.